Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland Family Charitable Fund. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life.
It's constantly redirecting your focus to that monitor, just like that.
Sounds demanding our attention and distracting us at the same time. I'm Mike and Scott, and this is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation.
You measure a sample, but you measure millions and billions of molecules all at the same time.
You get to see these patients over and over again. They become part of your family.
It's a virus that likes to attack lots of different organ systems.
You know, everything falls apart.
How about a bag of frozen peas to keep you comfy, plus...
Bingo.
So here's this population that never gets studied.
Pretty much all of cell biology
there
needs to kind of be redone.
For
I first opened a little
this
box
before
and there was a cell.
All of the surgeries that not prior to
yet. We're just giving you some of the medicine through your IV.
Basically, we wanted to know if there's any point to doing it.
What are you hearing right now? That music fading out, me talking, of course, but what else? Listen closely to the sounds around you for a moment, and you'll probably hear a lot more. Traffic, people, birds, maybe there's a dog barking. All day we tune into and out of the sounds around us. We focus on what we want to hear and try not to listen to sounds that distract us. For our show today, we've dug around in the archives for some great stories that all center around that concept of tuning in and out. We'll hear about a woman whose sense of hearing suddenly became incredibly acute, so much so that she could hear her own eyeballs move. Sounds pretty crazy, and it is. We'll find out how tuning into beautiful harp music can help patients tune out their pain, and we'll explore how surgeons fine-tune their focus in the operating room. But first up, a noise that is simultaneously very important and very detrimental to good healthcare. The beeping of monitors has become the ever-present audio wallpaper of hospital units. Medical devices monitoring patients send off alerts when something is not quite right. Heart rate is off, beep, pulse is low, beep, beep, ventilator seems to be malfunctioning, another alarm. Nurses can hear these alarms in their sleep.
Beep, beep. Yes, you dream about it.
For patients, they can be terrifying.
I can still hear that alarm today, and even when I just think about it, it gets my blood pumping and it gets the anxiety levels up.
But the thing is, the vast majority of these alarms are unnecessary.
99% of the alarms that we saw were not actionable, meaning that a true alarm, an alarm that you really needed to run in the door and save a patient, was truly like a needle in a haystack, like a 1% kind of a thing.
Chris Bonafide is a pediatrician at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. The 99% figure he just quoted applies to regular hospital units, but even in an intensive care setting, the vast majority of alarms do not mean a patient is in danger. For example, let's say the patient is a baby kicking his legs. That's what babies do. And the baby is kicking so much, the little sticker that holds the monitor sensor in place comes off.
So the device on the wall thinks that his heart rate is going way out of whack, but actually it's just fine and it's a happy kicking baby with a slightly loose kind of a lead.
Bonafide has been studying what happens when you get false alarm after false alarm, a phenomenon that's called alarm fatigue. He says when he walks around on the hospital unit, he hears the beeping, but it just fades into the background.
So when you hear this, you think...
I think it's probably nothing. I've sort of had to de-alarm fatigue myself because of the work that I'm doing, and it's actually been kind of hard.
Bonafide's been tracking how nurses respond to an alarm when they've already received lots and lots of alarms during their shift, and he found a relationship between that number and response times.
As you got up to the most extreme group, the group of nurses who had seen 80 or more alarms in the preceding 2 hours, their response time was several fold slower to future alarms when they had been exposed to that many alarms. So we thought that that was pretty consistent with alarm fatigue.
How slow is slow?
We're talking difference of minutes.
This is not a new issue. People started talking about it in the 1980s when hospitals and patient monitoring became much more high-tech. At the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, Bonafide says over 1,800 different devices are used in patient care, and most of them can send off alarms. And every time that beeping goes off, a nurse on the floor is alerted and has to make a decision.
Do I stop and interrupt this task that is probably really important to go and check on that other patient? So it's a difficult decision happening for a nurse. It can happen hundreds of times just in a single shift.
You may be calculating your medication dose and drawing up your meds and your alarm beeps, so you turn around to look at your phone or to look at your patient.
That's Children's Hospital Intensive Care Unit nurse Kara Terady.
And then to being able to start that process all over again and not just pick up in the middle, so you lessen the gap for error.
So basically, once you've interrupted, you go back to square one?
Correct.
So that sounds frustrating.
It can be. It can be very frustrating. I think it's something that we've just become accustomed to in the ICU.
Interruptions have been shown to cause medical errors, and among the medical staff, nurses suffer the brunt of all that beeping because they are first in line to check and see why the alarm is going off. That may be part of the reason it's taken so long for the medical community to pay attention to this issue, says Chris Bonafide.
The attitude for a long time, I think, was probably this is a nurse's problem and not a doctor's problem. So it didn't, I don't think, rise to the level that it has gotten to now. The way that we've sort of reframed it is, you know, it doesn't matter if it's a doctor or nurse's problem, because if it's a patient's problem, then it's all of our problem.
For his research, Bonafide captured hours and hours of video in patient care rooms to find out when and why alarms go off and how quickly nurses get there. Medical student Mimi Zander reviewed this footage for the study, and she also noticed how much alarms impact patients' well-being.
As an alarm fires, I can see if that woke the child up, and I can also see if that woke the parent up or if the parent is unsettled by the amount of alarms.
Your child is in a glass box hooked up to every conceivable kind of monitor, and you just don't know what's going on. It's frightening.
Mike Kennedy's son Alex was born just 27 weeks into the pregnancy. A tiny preemie weighing just 2 pounds, he spent 3 months in the NICU.
Our isolette was in the corner, so it was fairly far away from the nurse's station. So it took them a while to get there when something was going on.
Kennedy remembers the constant alarms and the nurses reassuring him and his wife Christine that it was nothing.
But there was one time in particular that it wasn't nothing.
The pulse ox alarm went off, and when Kennedy and his wife looked up to the monitor, they realized their son's oxygen level was going down rapidly. It fell below 30%.
And we could see coming out of his mouth and nose was formula, so it was clear that he was choking on the formula that he was being fed. And so we called over the nurses, and they were like, "Oh, it's okay, it's okay. He'll be fine, he'll be fine." And we're like, no, it's not fine. Something's going on here. We need you to get over here and take a look."
The incident haunted Kennedy, and the sound of alarms haunts him to this day, even though his son is a healthy 6-year-old now. Alarm fatigue has become a top priority for hospitals, and researchers everywhere are looking for ways to reduce the noise. Among them is engineer Keith Karn, who used to work in aviation. He's now a human factors specialist doing product design for a company called Bressler Group. He's attacking this problem with a seemingly basic question.
Why can't an ICU be more like a cockpit?
He says pilots would never put up with all of this beeping.
In an aircraft cockpit, you wouldn't tolerate it at all to have false alarms. If a particular component started giving you false signals, you would ground the airplane and, you know, take it in for maintenance and say, "What's the matter with this thing?"
Karn says one of the important lessons medicine could learn from aviation is to streamline information and to offer it at the right time.
In the case of combat, say in the heat of the battle, the pilot doesn't need to be reminded that his landing gear is up and retracted and safely stowed away as it should be. But when the pilot comes back to the base or back to the ship to land the airplane, he really wants to know and be checked to make sure that his landing gear is down.
Pediatrician Chris Bonafide says One simple step to reduce false alarms is to put only patients on monitors who truly need to be monitored, those who are critically ill. And he says monitors need to become smarter and only go off if certain conditions persist.
So we have the capability in some medical devices to put delays on to say, don't fire an alarm until that condition has existed for more than X number of seconds.
Bonafide says another simple step is to switch out the sticky sensors that hold monitors in place every 24 hours and to track which patients on a unit are setting off the most alarms and to investigate why this is happening. He's doing a 5-year study now with more video observations, and he hopes that within the next 10 years or so, alarms will finally become the useful tool they were intended to be, alerting care providers only to true problems. Mike Kennedy wrote this song about his family's experience in the NICU for his band Audible. It's called All Alarms.
The summer's over, can we breathe at last? We're giving up on some, but one by one we knew the days had to pass. We stared at images in black.
And I've also posted a longer version of Mike's story on our website, whyy.org/thepulse. You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott, and now we're going to move on to some sounds in a hospital you don't want to tune out. These soothing notes are floating through Lehigh Hospital outside of Boston, Massachusetts, to help patients forget about their pain and suffering for a little while. Paige Flager reports.
Right now, you're hearing two things. The first is the sound of a harp. It's being played by Jennifer Hollis. The second is the sound of an oxygen tank humming in the corner. A clear tube leads to Susan Steinbauer. She's laying in her hospital bed with her eyes closed, her hands folded over a blue crocheted blanket. She's 64 and has terminal cancer. When the music stops, Steinbauer opens her eyes.
It actually brought me back to a certain place in my childhood that, you know, when you're little, you run so free. And that's what it was. It was like the freedom feeling.
Jennifer Hollis is more than a harpist. She's what's called a music thanatologist. She plays the harp and sings for dying patients. So, if life was a movie, Hollis plays the music during the closing credits. Her profession is really rare. She's the only music thanatologist in the northeastern United States, and there are less than 100 music thanatologists worldwide. She had never heard about this field until she came across an article back in 1995. She had played music all her life and decided that this was something that she really wanted to explore.
At that point, it sounded very strange to people that someone who was about to graduate from college was going to go off and move from the Boston area. And the only training program at that time in the world was in Missoula, Montana.
She took classes in anthropology, music theory, anatomy, and physiology, and she had regular voice and harp lessons. The defining characteristic of music thanatology is what Hollis calls the prescriptive process. She explains that music thanatologists think of the raw elements of music, like melody, harmony, rhythm, and tonality, and then they use those things to respond to different moods of hospital rooms.
So if a patient has restlessness, agitation, I would start thinking prescriptively about what are the qualities of music that might be able to address that in some way.
For the last 10 years, Hollis has been going to Lehigh Hospital outside of Boston to play for dying patients. Sometimes the patient response is physical. They might breathe more deeply, or their facial expression might relax. More often than not, she'll play a room full of people straight to sleep. But she's not insulted by that.
It's such a compliment, because it means that people are, they're relaxed, that they feel safe, and they feel comfortable.
Other times, the response to the music is really emotional, and not just for the patients. Families might use this time to tell stories about their loved one, to pray, or to say goodbye.
The interesting thing about music thanatology, I think, is that in some ways it's medicine that you can give both to the patient and to their family.
There's not a whole lot of research backing up the benefits of music thanatology. Beth Collins is the medical director of Lahey Hospital's palliative care program. She says that at first, when she heard about Jennifer Hollis and her work, she was really worried that her unit might be seen as soft or touchy-feely by other doctors. That is, until she saw Jennifer Hollis in action. Then, she didn't really care about the science.
I don't think things have to be proven. I think they just have to work. And to me, my God, this is a heck of a lot better than giving somebody some medication that's going to change things going on in their body. If her work is able to help a heart rate slow down and someone not breathe as hard and be more comfortable, that's better than anything, I think.
Collins says there's only been one complaint about Jennifer Hollis in the time that she's been visiting the hospital.
The only thing is sometimes some patients' families have said, oh my God, no. If my father ever opened his eyes and saw somebody with a harp near his bed, he would think he had already died.
But the harp reminding people of those pearly white gates isn't always a bad thing, Hollis says.
I think for some people, it's evocative in a very positive way, where they love the idea that their loved one, especially if they're not conscious and speaking anymore, might hear the music and feel like they were in heaven.
Susan Steinbauer passed away earlier this year. Paige Flager reported this piece.
Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse. Independence is coming to your neighborhood to help you understand healthcare options. Licensed agents can help prepare you for whatever may be ahead. Learn more at ibx.com/events. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.
This is The Pulse. We bring you stories about health, science, and innovation from around the country. I'm Mike and Scott. Today, we're listening to some of our favorite pieces from the archives, and they are all stories about how sound changes our focus. Todd Bookman brings us this amazing story of one woman's ordeal as her hearing went haywire.
Back in the spring of 2006, Pam Gilbert was having a typical weekend at her home in suburban Virginia.
It was a Sunday afternoon. I was out doing some yard work with my husband. Some neighbors stopped by. We were talking, and I felt like somebody was pulling me to the right, like they had a rope tied around my shoulders and were pulling me. And I just felt a little off balance, and I asked them if I was leaning, and we, you know, they asked me, you know, had I been drinking? And we just all just thought it was funny because I was leaning to the right.
Pam, who is in her mid-40s at the time, doesn't think too much of it, but the symptoms don't let up.
And within a couple of days, I wasn't able to walk. I had severe vertigo. I was vomiting. And it got so bad that my husband took me to the emergency room.
Had you ever experienced anything like this before?
Never had a dizzy spell. It was just so out of the ordinary, we didn't know what was going on.
At the ER, the doctors don't spot anything out of the ordinary. They diagnose Pam with an ear infection and send her home. But a few more weeks pass, and the dizziness is still there.
I could not drive a car. I wouldn't have been able to pass a sobriety test. I was just really unsteady. Felt like I was in a fun house, but not so fun.
The days go by, and soon Pam figures out a way to treat herself. She simply stops moving her head, like she won't turn it from side to side to look at something. Instead, she rotates her whole body.
And so I was moving much like a robot would.
And that robot movement, though a bit bizarre, pretty much settles everything down. The vertigo subsides, and she's able to get back to her regular life. Pam has two kids, she's involved with Girl Scouts and the Neighborhood Association. Whatever this spell was, it seems to have passed, as long as she keeps her head locked in position. But as time passes, Pam notices something strange starting to happen with her ears. Her hearing becomes extremely acute, extremely sensitive. She starts picking up all these sounds she had never noticed before.
One day, I was upstairs in my bedroom. We live in a two-story house, and we have a basement. And I looked at my husband, and I said, as some wives will do, "Honey, the faucet in the bathroom is dripping. Can you go turn it off?" And since his side of the bed is closer to the bathroom, he assumed I meant the sink in our bathroom. But what I could hear was it was the sink in the basement had a dripping faucet, and I asked him to go turn it off, and he was like, "You can't possibly hear that." And sure enough, he went downstairs, and it was dripping.
It was as if Pam had suddenly developed this superpower.
It's kind of like, you know, how birds and bees can see different colors because they just have that ability. I could hear sounds that other people couldn't hear.
All these normally muted noises of daily life start catching her attention.
I could hear when the kids would roll over in bed, even though they were two doors away. My door was closed and their door was closed.
She could hear every mouse scurrying through the wall.
If there was a leaf on the roof, I heard it.
Pam's hearing begins to take over her life. These noises start dominating her consciousness.
And then I noticed the sounds began to hurt. And it became a psychological fear of sound because I could hear everything.
The telephone became unusable because holding the handset up to her ear was like having a megaphone blasted 2 inches from your head. She couldn't go inside her kid's school because teenager screams and the echoes off the linoleum were like daggers. So she decided to go back to the doctors.
I was seeing all the ear specialists, and I went to a neurologist who, you know, told me, I hate to say this, but he said, "You're just a bored housewife looking for attention. Here's a handful of pills."
Pam knew there was something more serious going on. During the next few months, the external sounds she heard so clearly were joined by internal sounds, by noises coming from inside her own body.
I had this booming heartbeat in my ears. I had this tinnitus, this ringing in the ears, a constant note, just like a blaring horn in my head. Those sounds were unshakable. There wasn't any way to turn them down. They never went away. I could hear the bones in my neck cracking, you know, just kind of like sandpaper. At one point, I could hear my eyes move.
Yes, you heard that correctly, her eyeballs. When Pam reads a book, the tinnitus in her ears starts correlating with her eye movement across the page.
So it would be squealing till I got to the end of the line, and when I moved my eyes to the beginning of the next line, it was a different kind of squeal. Just as painful, just as loud, just a different note. There were days where I thought, my brain was going to be vibrated into oatmeal. There were just times where you just couldn't think straight because of the noise going on internally.
I asked Pam if she could describe the sounds in her head, what it was like to live with this.
Yeah.
She asked me to follow her to the garage. We hop into the Honda.
So this is what it's like. You ready?
Yeah.
That's what it's like 24/7. There's no volume control, and there's no way to turn it off.
Ricky Martin, car speakers, top volume. This is not a good way to go through life. By this point, Pam is basically living as a hermit. She's avoiding all public settings, turning down dinner invitations, and not going on Girl Scout trips. She also begins to develop a system of signs to communicate with her husband and kids, who know there is something going on, obviously, but don't fully understand the extent to which she's suffering.
When I was in the depths of, I'm going crazy, and this isn't anything that talk therapy is going to help with, there's not a pill I can take. I'm the bad kind of crazy. I can hear things that other people can't. So I'm really deeply disturbed, and I have to hide this from everyone.
At this point, the only moments of relief came in the evening when she would put on talk radio.
So I would turn on NPR. All Things Considered was music to my ears because it was
All Things Considered.
So
and I'm Robert Sheik.
Beautifully matched to the sounds going on in my head. It would mask all those sounds, and I was able to sleep. So I don't know if you'll want to put this on the radio, but I used NPR to fall asleep.
You know, a lot of people find public radio boring enough to put you to sleep.
It's not boring. It was just this tone that was calming and soothing, and it wasn't syncopated. It was very, it was smooth.
We are definitely going to replay this story during our next pledge drive. But anyways, in 2008, so 2 years into this disorder, Pam finds herself back at the doctor's office. But not for her hearing issue.
I don't know. Maybe I had a sore throat or something. And I went to see my family doctor. And he just took me by my arms. And this is the family doctor. And he held me and he got up in my face and said, there's something very, very wrong with you. And we have to find out what it is because these medications may hide the next symptom that leads to your diagnosis.
He sends her to get more tests at yet another ear, nose, and throat doctor, who takes a look at her and says,
wow, you got some really strange symptoms. I've never even seen any of this before, but I'm going to send you to Johns Hopkins. These guys are really good, and they'll be able to figure out what's wrong with you.
I'm Lloyd Miner, and I'm Dean of Medicine at Stanford University.
And you spent some time in Baltimore, right, at Johns Hopkins?
I did. I spent 19 years at Johns Hopkins.
Miner is also an ear, nose, and throat doctor, but his specialty is the inner ear and the balance system, also called the vestibular system.
Our inner ear, our vestibular system, is like our gyroscope. It tells our brain how our head is moving, and we use it all the time. It's our inner ear, it's our balanced vestibular system that enables us to drive a car along a bumpy road. Because when you're driving a car or when you're running, your head's bouncing up and down, but you don't have any trouble looking at road signs, at other things in front of you. And the reason you don't is that for every head movement, that head movement's being detected by your inner ear, and your eyes are moving in a way that compensates for the head movement.
So this balance system is at the heart of how we move through the world, how our senses, like sight and hearing, work together to feed the brain information about spatially where we are. Dr. Miner is an expert in this relationship. And in the spring of 1995, a patient comes in with a vestibular system problem.
And I saw a gentleman in his mid-50s who came in with kind of a bizarre complaint. He said that when he sang in the shower, he saw things moving. And he was very specific about the way in which they moved. And he said, you know, they're moving as if they're moving about a clock face.
The shampoo bottle, the loofah, they almost rotate when he starts singing.
And in fact, he said, look, I can show you if you just, you know, give me something where I can put a loud noise in my my right ear, I can show you because when I'm looking, you know, at myself in loud noises, I see my eyes move.
So Miner gets a piece of equipment, makes a tone in the patient's right ear, and he sees the guy's eyes jump.
They weren't random eye movements. They were very tightly timed and linked to the sound, and they were always in the same direction.
And this fact that they jumped the same way each time turned out to be a huge clue for Miner. Our vestibular system is composed of three tiny little fluid-filled canals. They're so small, all three of them would fit on top of a dime, and they're tucked inside the inner ear. Miner suspected that the canals must somehow be involved with the way this guy's eyes were moving, and he had this suspicion because of, well, pigeons.
Pigeons became involved because the way people over a century ago discovered that the inner ear had a role in control of eye movements and in balance. A lot of those original studies were done in pigeons.
Researchers, including an Italian biologist named Pietro Tullio, would, I don't know, strap down these birds and remove the bone over one of the canals.
And then they would push on the membranous portion of the canal, the fluid-filled portion of the canal, and they would observe that the pigeon's eyes, and oftentimes its head, moved in the plane of that canal.
Just like his patient, the guy who sings in the shower, the eyes of the pigeon would jolt the same way.
And therefore, it seemed to me, there had to be a similar problem in these patients. Somehow, the bone was likely to be missing over that top balance canal.
Miner had made the discovery. He figured out that this tiny layer of bone, for whatever reason, isn't there in patients with this condition, which he dubs superior semicircular canal dehiscence. Dehiscence being the word for rupture or opening. And because there is now this opening, sound waves, which usually travel through the middle ear and then into the inner ear without disrupting these canals, instead, the waves now kind of rumble right through them.
The balance canal, the top balance canal, becomes a sound receptor.
It's almost like an escape route. This sound energy is supposed to be moving from A to B, and then it just leaks.
That's right. Supposed to be moving from A to B, but then all of a sudden C opens up. And now it can move from A to B, and it can move from A to C.
That's what explains why these patients have heightened sensitivity to external sounds, and also the noises inside the body, like the muscles that move our eyeballs. It's like this seal that's supposed to be in place to protect us from these noises has a hole torn through it.
We can think of the vestibular system ordinarily as being a black box that we never have to think about. It's always there. It's doing its job. And then when there's this opening or when there's another problem with the way the vestibular system works, then all of a sudden, you know, everything falls apart.
I just remember Dr. Miner saying you had this condition and us just looking at each other like, holy cow, I'm not crazy.
Just knowing there was something physically wrong was a huge relief to Pam Gilbert and her husband. It meant the problem was in her head, but it wasn't in her head. Dr. Miner explained the treatment he helped pioneer, how he could go in through her skull, lift up her brain, and get access to the bone protecting her canal, where he could then plug up this 2-millimeter hole.
We leave Johns Hopkins, we come home, and I'm like, did he say brain surgery?
It is a serious surgery. There's the chance hearing in her right ear could be permanently lost. There's a small chance for facial paralysis. And like every time you open up the skull, something unexpected could happen. But Pam wasn't going to be the first to get the surgery. And overall, it's considered a good option for people with severe symptoms. Pam, though, doesn't see it this way. She's just not thinking logically anymore.
My ability at that point to take in complex information, process it, make a thoughtful, reasoned surgical decision is just ludicrous. I'm an animal at this point. I can't tie my shoes and have a conversation at the same time. So I find out I need this surgery, and in my mind, I've converted that to a death sentence.
She's totally exhausted, totally worn down after years of this cacophony in her head. And rather than opt for the surgery, she makes a deal with herself, a deal she now realizes was totally irrational.
I think, well, my daughter's in high school now. I can live like this for 4 more years, and then I'll just be gone. It was magical thinking, delusional thinking. I would just disappear. Never said the word suicide, but I was just going to be gone. Because once my kids were through high school, I will have done my duty. And I would just be gone.
And then September of her daughter's freshman year arrives, and Pam notices a new symptom, something called autophony.
So autophony is this symptom where you can hear your own voice. And, well, everyone can hear their own voice. But with this, you hear your voice as loud as you can think of, like a rock concert. That's what your voice becomes. Only it's a rock concert of fingernails on a chalkboard.
Speaking in anything above a whisper is like a stick of dynamite going off in her head.
Certain letters make certain vibrations. I couldn't say the letter M. Too much vibration.
When your name is Pam and you lose the letter M, you are in bad shape. Living, being awake, existing in this world had become a total nightmare.
It just sounds so silly. It just sounds so silly. But it's torture. Superior canal dehiscence syndrome is torture. There's just no pretty way to make a cute analogy. It makes you want to kill yourself in the end. And if you don't get diagnosed, that's what some people do.
So on March 4th, 2011, Pam goes in for surgery. This procedure, she's convinced, will kill her.
And I went, asked the anesthesiologist to give me something for nerves, because I'm having brain surgery. And I kissed my husband goodbye, and I thought that was it. But I couldn't do any more. I said goodbye. So, imagine my surprise when I wake up from surgery. I'm awake, and the world is peaceful. It's a whole new world. It's a whole new world, and it doesn't hurt to just lay there. And I knew it worked. I said the letter M. Said it quietly. I don't know that anybody heard me, but it was just the letter M. It wasn't this vibration machine that turning my brain to mush. It was just another letter. It was amazing.
This story was produced by Todd Bookman and mixed by Charlie Kyer. Special thanks to Pam Gilbert, of course, and also to Dr. John Carey at Johns Hopkins Medicine for his help with this story. This is The Pulse, bringing you stories about health, science, and innovation. I'm Mike and Scott, and today we're listening back to some of our favorite stories about sound. This next one takes us into the operating room. Scalpels, suction tubes, scopes, these are some of the instruments you'll find there. But when the patient is knocked out, many doctors take out another tool, music. Melodies play an important role in the OR, but what are surgeons listening to, and who gets to pick? Reporter Alana Gordon takes us on this sonic journey to dissect some of the playlists.
Today happened to be a Jethro Tull day. From Aqualung to Thick as a Brick.
For Dr. Charles Yeo, amid all the sounds of the operating room, the heart monitors, IV drips, music is also a constant.
We listen to all sorts of great songs.
It's getting better all the time.
His unit at Thomas Jefferson University in Philadelphia usually prefers classic rock or straight-up country. The selection depends on their mood, or even the season.
Surfing is the only life, the only way for me now, surf.
When spring comes around,
surf.
We're hopeful, so we'll have a Beach Boys day.
Now, patients might be wondering, is this surgeon just having a beach party during a critical moment? Yeo says familiar, nostalgic music actually helps him do his job.
Does that have anything to do with operating on the pancreas? Of course not, but it brings me back to a time that I remember as a very carefree time, and therefore I think it takes the pressure off.
Music in the operating room is kind of a thing. Yeo recalls when he started in the 70s, ORs had it, even though hospitals banned radios.
But we used to sneak them in anyway.
Technology has come a long way since those little transistor radios.
They used to bring their little boom boxes, and we listened to it.
Krista Bonifante is a nurse at Hahnemann Hospital.
Now they have iPods with their little iPod speakers, so things have evolved.
Not all doctors listen to music, but I reached out to several hospitals and got lots of responses. Hahnemann alone is a cacophony of melodies, depending on the surgeon and the team.
Some days we'll listen to Elvis, some days we'll listen to Rod Stewart.
I usually play a mixture of rock, punk.
That is Dr. Scott Land. Lauren Charles is another nurse.
Usually I'll take a survey of the room before. We listen to a lot of Pandora here.
Classical.
Johnny Cash puts me over the edge, and I'm like, we're really not going to listen to Johnny Cash today, are we?
Also Paul Simon.
That's Dr. Julia Spears. If the patient's awake, it's always their choice. Some research suggests music can create a calming effect. Certain ORs have rituals.
Wednesday is usually some type of jazz.
And Friday?
Start spreading the news.
Everyone scrubs in.
New York, New York.
And it's Frank Sinatra all day long.
If I can.
These can be long operations.
The music keeps us going. It puts us in a good mood.
It's up to you.
At times, there can be a discordance in taste.
Dr. Mitra, his music is,
it's questionable. Yesterday, I was tortured by his opera music. It was bearable. It was bearable.
My music would be pretty slow music.
Dr. Amitrava Mitra is a plastic surgeon at Hahnemann. Again, Boninfante.
He'll just sit there and like he meditates a little bit. He gets real quiet and he listens to it, and then he'll go out and scrub into surgery.
Because in microsurgery, if you're agitated, you get a little bit of a tremor. If you're calmed down, you don't get a tremor. And you can stitch the arteries and microscopic stuff pretty easily.
The selection also depends on what's happening in the surgery.
For example, if I'm doing a breast reconstruction, for example, at the end of the operation, it's about an hour, hour and a half worth of stitching. It's essentially walking a mile. So in those cases, we can put any music and do it because it's a routine step.
No matter how much a doctor might like it, some music is never appropriate for an operating room.
Don't play things like Another One Bites the Dust by Queen.
Another One Bites the Dust.
Dr. David Bosanquet is a surgical resident in South Wales. He recently put together a fun essay and OR playlist for the British Medical Journal. He has some alternate suggestions.
Staying Alive by the Bee Gees, that's always a good one.
His preference.
Fix You by Coldplay.
Bad puns aside, Bosanquet wanted to know more about this trend he kept finding in the OR. Turns out, music has struck a chord in medicine for centuries. 100 years ago, the well-known surgeon Evan Kane wrote a brief for the Journal of the American Medical Association, specifically on the, quote, calming and positive properties of the phonograph for both the patient and surgeon.
So it's interesting to see this pioneer linking music and the beneficial effects in the operating room.
Kane's big claim to fame was taking out his own appendix. Bosanquet says literature suggests that nowadays up to 70% of surgeons listen to something. He points to the limited evidence, mostly surveys and observational studies, that finds that music can be advantageous.
To aid concentration and keep everybody focused.
Not everyone agrees.
If it's a very complicated operation, for example, then there is an issue that it drowns out the senses and can actually reduce performance.
So, helpful music for some, maybe a detractor for others.
And I think it's partly to do with how brains are wired.
Dr. Scott Levin is chair of orthopedic surgery at the University of Pennsylvania.
So when I listen to music in the operating room, particularly Julian Bream or John Williams playing the guitar, they're absolute perfectionists, and what I hear is perfect music. And so perhaps subconsciously I say, the surgical detail or the part of the surgery that I'm performing needs to be commensurate with that degree of perfection and excellence that allows me to do my surgery better.
Again, David Bosanquet.
I have heard anecdotal evidence of, you know, hard metal being played in theatre. And I can only imagine finding that hugely distracting.
My favorite band is probably Metallica.
Dr. Timothy Schmidt is a surgeon at one of the biggest transplant centers in the country in Kansas City.
You know, I would find classical music distracting. Country music is really not appropriate for the OR.
Of course, he's a heavy metal guy. So is his surgical tech, Christopher Washington.
I think transplant team is a different breed. It's perfect for us. It calms us down.
Doing liver transplant and big cancer cases, we have to be aggressive sometimes and decisive when we do the things we do in the operating room, so it kind of suits our personality.
Washington says the OR is not some Danzig or Tool concert. There's no mosh pit. The music is just audible, so everyone can be attuned to the important stuff. And even though musical tastes may clash from one OR to the next, there does appear to be a harmonious agreement on this. If the operation becomes really complicated, if it takes an unexpected turn, the soundtrack becomes silence.
If things get a little too out of hand, we know how to turn them off.
If you notice that things are getting a little intense, we can turn off the music.
Except that time, we may ask people just to be quiet completely.
But when they're in the clear again, the music comes back on. For The Pulse, I'm Alana Gordon.
Dr.
that's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Tanya English, Alana Gordon, Todd Bookman, and Irina Zhorov. Joel Wolfram is our intern, Charlie Kayar, our engineer, Paige Flager, our associate producer, Joel Patterson is the managing editor, and Megan Pinto, our executive producer. The piece we just heard about the surgeons and the music they listen to in the OR just won a big national prize, first prize in a radio competition, and so did an episode of The Pulse that we called The Pulse Goes to School. Take a listen to it. It started out like this.
Attention all students. This is your principal, Mike and Scott, speaking. And today we're going to listen to The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation.
I haven't been allowed near the station's intercom system since that day. That episode is on iTunes. I hope you take a listen.
Ben Franklin Technology Partners of Southeastern Pennsylvania supports WHYY's The Pulse and are partners with a purpose, providing capital, counsel, and connections to technology entrepreneurs and investors in the greater Philadelphia area. More about Ben at partnerswithapurpose.org.